human mind loves novelty. And there's even this factor called the novelty bias, whereby for every new and novel thing we direct our attention at, our brain rewards us with a hit of dopamine. And so we wake up and we bounce around between our stable of applications. We go to Threads, and then Twitter, and then Instagram, and we get another hit of dopamine. We check the news, we get another hit of dopamine. We bounce over to Facebook, we get another hit of dopamine. We go back to Instagram, we get another hit of dopamine. Bouncing around in this dopamine-fueled feedback loop. And really, it is chemical reinforcement that happens after we engage with a certain behavior.
Welcome to Freedom Matters, where we explore the intersection of technology, productivity, and digital well-being. I'm your host, Georgie Powell, and each episode we'll be talking to experts in productivity and digital wellness. We'll be sharing their experiences on how to take back control of technology. We hope you leave feeling inspired, so let's get to it. This week, I'm in conversation with Chris Bailey. Chris is an author and lecturer who explores the science behind living a deeper, more intentional life. He is the international best-selling author of How to Calm Your Mind, Hyperfocus, and The Productivity Project, which have been published in 35 languages around the world. His latest TED Talk, How to Get Your Brain to Focus, has been viewed over 13 million times. He is a global productivity expert. However, it took an on-stage panic attack for Chris to recognise how critical it is to invest in calm at the same time that we invest in becoming more productive. Productivity advice works, and we need it now more than ever, but it's just as vital that we develop our capacity for calm. Today we dive into his most recent book, How to Calm Your Mind, to understand the difference between anxiety and calm, why calm is so powerful, and importantly, and crucially, how to find it. We hope you enjoy this episode of Freedom Matters.
Welcome to the Freedom Matters podcast. It is amazing to have you here. Here we are.
Here we are. Look at us.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought? Just two kids from Canada. And where are you from?
I'm from England, but I'm currently in Portugal.
Oh, where in Portugal?
Yeah. I'm in just outside Lisbon in a town called Sintra.
Oh, Portuguese people feel very Canadian to me. I don't know what it is. Whenever I go to Portugal, I get a Canadian energy from people. Yeah, cool vibes all around.
We're having a good time, Anyway,
I love it.
I really wanted to get in to talk about your book and to really dive deeply today into the topic of calm.
Yeah.
And I know that one of the things you do in your book is you position the relationship between anxiety and calm. And I'd love to start there. I'd love to understand from you how you see anxiety and how you see calm and how they relate to each other.
Yeah, for sure. Originally, when I started exploring, trying to get over my own anxiety, because it was something that I was going through myself, I was thinking, okay, how do I just get rid of my anxiety? But then looking at the research on anxiety, on calm, I really came to the conclusion that these two ideas are the same idea, basically. They live on the spectrum with one another. So if anxiety is on one end, we can keep going past that point of no anxiety that lives in the middle of this gradient of how we feel, past it to the point of calm, where we continue to become less emotionally reactive to things as they happen around us. We have a settled state of mind where we have the capacity to really take on whatever comes our way. I think calm kind of engenders these images of just, I don't know, meditating on a beach or some boring life or something, but it's really the capacity to live your life and the foundation upon which we're able to stand. Down the spectrum from anxiety past the point of no anxiety to calm, we settle down, we become clear-headed, and we're able to think clearly. We're able to see things as they are and focus and become more creative. And the science is fascinating and the benefits are even better in my opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting. See, calm is actually quite an active state in that it's elevated. It unlocks capabilities that you probably wouldn't experience if you were in that kind of non-anxious state but hadn't yet moved through to being truly calm.
That's exactly it. And there's a direct productivity connection as well, because we think, what's the connection between calm and productivity? They seem two mutually exclusive, disparate topics. But really, the research is quite fascinating with the connection between the two. If you were about to give a presentation in front of 5,000 people, let's say, and the presentation starts in 10 minutes, and I asked you, hey, I wrote this book on calm. Do you want to read it? First of all, you probably wouldn't want to. And second of all, it would probably take you 2, 3, 4 times as long to get through a page than it would just on a regular Saturday afternoon where you have the day free to yourself. And this is the benefit of a calm state of mind. Anxiety actually shrinks one measure of our cognitive capacity called our working memory capacity by about 20%. So we have less processing power to give to the world around us. Anxiety limits our cognitive performance in general. It makes us more distractible. We get more negative self-talk. We feel less engaged, less present with whatever we're doing and whomever it is that we're with. And so it's a really interesting connection between calm and cognitive performance, where anxiety doesn't just rob us of these mental resources that we need to do a good job of, especially knowledge work, but calm adds to this capacity, the research shows, by expanding our working memory, by expanding our cognitive performance, by getting us out of this emotionally reactive state so that we become less distractible and we don't really look as often for threats in our environment, which is another big factor. So we don't pay too much attention to that one negative email. Sometimes we get one negative email out of 100, and that's the one that we can't stop thinking about, even though it's maybe the least important out of the 100, right? That's our threat-finding mind that is really revved up by episodes of anxiety. Our self-talk doesn't get in the way of us performing what we need to perform, and we actually feel like we're in the tracks, right? We feel like we're moving forward. It's this amazing, really, capacity of the mind that we don't necessarily unlock, but it's tough to notice sometimes when we're anxious, when we're inside of that state. And that's something that I noticed myself leading up to this journey. I was anxious without realizing about it, and my cognitive performance was capped in a really significant way that I wasn't quite aware of at the time.
So fascinating, isn't it? Because I think so many of us have just got used to a work life where sort of an underlying level of kind of chronic stress makes us feel like we are needed and valuable and busy. And when that goes away, you feel like, oh, I can't possibly be being productive because I don't feel right. Like I'm not under pressure. Is there any instance where anxiety is useful for productivity?
Oh, that's a really good question. You know, stress is often helpful for productivity. We need stress to get out of bed in the morning, right? Or else we would just hang around on our phone. We need events. We need stressful situations that get us out of there. Where I'd come at that from is we're really bad at measuring how productive we are. And this is something I think a lot about. It used to be very easy to measure how productive we were because we worked in a factory. The work was simple. It was repetitive. But these days, when we do knowledge work, when we're writing lines of code, when we're writing reports, when we're communicating with others, it's really difficult to measure how well we do with cognitive work. And so we tend to look at proxy measures for how productive we were at the end of the day. And so we'll think, okay, how busy was I today? I was very busy, so I must have been productive. And the evaluating part of our mind sees that we're busy. And that kind of leads us to trick ourselves into being productive. So we move a lot of emails and bits and people around, playing the role of the, pick the analogy you want, the traffic cop, the air traffic controller, the firefighter, dealing with emergencies, but don't necessarily move things forward in that regard. And there are a lot of other measures of productivity too. Exhaustion is one that we look to often, where if we're wiped at the end of the day, we think, oh, I'm totally wiped. I must have been productive today. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we were. And so it's a very tricky thing to measure this cognitive performance with productivity in the knowledge work economy that we live inside of today.
Yeah, you're right. And that's totally why we all cling to this kind of busyness mindset and this comforting feeling of I'm feeling stressed, therefore I'm busy and productive. So how have you reset that? I want to come back to that. I've got a whole lot of other questions completely off track, but just quickly, how are you getting better at defining your own productivity whilst also trying to nurture that sense of calm?
To me, it comes down to one thing, and that one thing is intentionality. And in my opinion, after researching this topic of productivity for the last decade or so, writing about it, I really think that productivity begins and ends with intentionality, and that intention lies at the heart of what it means to be productive. And you can have a day where you're relaxing on a beach, you're drinking pina coladas, you're reading books, you're listening to podcasts, you're doing all these things that you intended to do. And if you accomplish the things that you intend to do on a day like that, I would argue that you're perfectly productive, right? Because you produced the result that you were after, which is ultimately, I think, what productivity is about. And the same thing could be said if you intend to have a big day at work and answer and catch up with 500 emails and write a 1,000-word report and have 4 or 5 Zoom meetings, and then you do, I would argue that you're perfectly productive in that context too. It all comes back to the intentions that we set, and in my opinion, whether they're aligned with what we truly value on that deep, fundamental human level, because then they're meaningful, then we become far more likely to be engaged with them. So the way that I do it is every morning, I set 3 daily intentions. And so I'll turn around to my whiteboard here and see what they are today. Number one is to clear all my email. Might be a daunting task. Number two is to enjoy the calls and the interviews I have today. Number three is to, deal with all the admin backlog that has been accumulating over the last little while as I've focused on projects that are honestly more important. And so I'll do other things too, obviously, right? If we did 3 things all day, every day, we probably wouldn't have a job after much of a period of time because our work is more complex than that. But at the end of the day, this is what I'll look at because these are the things that I want to get out of my day this morning and what I wish to be actually productive on. And it's really about that forethought of what's important and then the reflection on whether we have followed through with what is truly important on a given day. So that's how I do it.
So at the end of the day, how do you retrospect on every day?
Oh, I review these things all day long. So I'm always walking by the whiteboard, and this is how I've always done it.
So wait, does that mean that if we have intention behind everything that we do in a day, that everything has equal importance? Is deep work not more important than busy work? How can we assess the relative value of the two?
I really do believe that there is a fundamental nature of our work where not all of what we do is created equal. And so if you look at all of the different things that you could do at any one moment, there are certain things that you could do. Let's say you finish the podcast, you're fired up, ready to work, and you look at the 20 things that you could be doing before you, right? And if you're perfect, which nobody is, and you perfectly accommodate your values, your overarching goals, what you wish to accomplish, what's important in your work, what's meaningful to you, what you have to do, what you must do, what you wish to do, what's just fun. I think fun is an underrated component of work as well. Mm-hmm. Work isn't nearly as fun as it should be and as it can be. And there are ways that we can reframe things in that regard. So if you accommodate for all of these factors in the intentions that you set and you're perfect in every way, then maybe deep work is overrated. I don't know. But at the same time, I think that's a bit of a pipe dream for a lot of us that don't spend all day thinking about productivity.
Yeah, I really wish I could, but I cannot live with intention every single second of my day.
Yeah, there's like a spectrum too, right? If you're a monk meditating in a cave all day long, you're going to find it that most of your day is deliberate and intentional. But most of us aren't a monk in a cave. We collide with the real world often in catastrophic ways. And we find that things don't go as we wish they would. Of course, intentionality is a core component of productivity. maybe the core component of productivity. But there's also, of course, the saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And so there is that collision with reality. Oh, there goes gravity that we sometimes have.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And this brings us really nicely back to this kind of anxiety-calm dichotomy, because as you were saying before, when you live in a state of calm, it is much easier to see that intentionality and to feel like you're being purposeful in the way that you're working or choosing to live your life. Even more reasons to come back to it. What I wanted to touch on was, you talked before about how you hadn't realized that you were living in a state of anxiety, but you were. And then obviously you realized that you actually had hit burnout. So I'd love to understand that a bit more about why you think you hadn't realized that you were actually really stressed.
Yeah, it's that fish in water phenomenon where if you're a fish, I'm going to butcher this old parable and I forget where it's from as well. But if you ask a fish, how's the water today? The fish might say, what's water? And so if you ask me at the start of this journey, how is your anxiety today? I would say, what anxiety? I don't feel anxious. But then it wasn't until, I guess, after it was too late, you could say, that I started to deconstruct the symptoms that I was experiencing and facing. And so I had a panic attack on stage giving a talk on productivity. Luckily, made it through the rest of the talk on autopilot mode because I had rehearsed quite a bit. But picking up the pieces after that particular episode, realized all of the symptoms of anxiety that I was having, but just wasn't aware of, that wasn't breaking through into my conscious awareness, from the racing thoughts and the uncontrollable thoughts to always feeling on edge to having a difficulty concentrating and sleeping and having the rapid heart rate and palpitations and dizziness, lightheadedness, this feeling of impending fear and doom sometimes. I thought, oh, this is just what it's like to be human, to have a human mind, not seeing how I was feeling and the situation that I was in as a consequence of not necessarily respecting my own mental health. And the way I respond to any challenges that I basically face is, what does the research show? Noticing this disconnect that I was having, that the people around me were having as well, it led me down the rabbit hole of research, poured over countless journal articles on topics like burnout, like you said, like anxiety, like engagement, cognitive performance and productivity, you name it. I nerded out over it. And it was fascinating. You know, burnout is a really interesting phenomenon because a lot of these results of chronic stress that we face, we don't really connect to stress. And so we feel burnt out, which burnout is a confluence of being exhausted, cynical, and feeling unproductive. And we think, oh, I'm just burnt out. I must be overworked. But really, there's a direct connection between any burnout that we face and the chronic stress that we experience every day as well. I think the key takeaway was we can feel a certain way and not realize that we do, because we get so used to a source of stress or a source of discomfort that it becomes just the background noise of our mind. We think it's normal to be anxious. We think it's normal to be unproductive, or we don't even realize that we are being unproductive or anxious. And it becomes just that fish and water phenomenon that we settle into. Yeah, I think first step is awareness for basically any behavior change, in my opinion. But then you figure out what to do with it.
And you learned a lot, obviously, by nerding out, as you say, understanding more about what your body had gone through and trying to understand how to reset. And I'm really interested in some of the steps that you took. One of the things you talk about in the book is your dopamine fast, which is different to the digital detoxes that we talk about, because it goes one step further of stripping dopamine out from across your life. So can you tell us a bit more about the experience of that and sort of why you chose to do it and how it played out?
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, the whole idea of a dopamine fast, I found really interesting and honestly, maybe a little bit gimmicky at the start. And I put off doing it for that reason. I thought, oh, it's all these Silicon Valley bros that are doing these dopamine fasts. I don't know if this is for me. But then I kept coming across this idea of calm and of mental stimulation. And first of all, we can't really fast from dopamine, is something that quickly discovered, because dopamine, it drives creative thinking. It drives focused thinking. When we're being productive and in the pilot seat of the work that we're doing, dopamine is released in a situation such as that when we do logical or creative work. I put off the idea, but then I thought, okay, I'm just going to try this thing, see how it works. And I was honestly shocked at how well a stimulation fast worked. I call it a stimulation fast instead of a dopamine fast, because we can't really fast from dopamine any more than we can fast from carbohydrates on a chemical level. First of all, we identify the behaviors and the activities and the distractions that we primarily engage with for the purposes of obtaining a hit of dopamine. There's a few factors that determine the size of a dopamine spike in our mind. So there's genetics, which is the common denominator that we have with all of these activities. There's salience or direct effects. So whether something directly affects our life. So if we get a $5,000 bonus one day and we find a $5 bill on the street, all other things being equal, we will get a much higher spike from the raise. But the third factor, which differs most between the different tasks, so it's the one that I like to focus on and think about in terms of my own life and in the book as well, is novelty. Our human mind loves novelty. And there's even this factor called the novelty bias, whereby for every new and novel thing we direct our attention at, our brain rewards us with a hit of dopamine. And so we wake up and we bounce around between our stable of applications. We go to Threads and then Twitter and then Instagram and we get another hit of dopamine. We check the news, we get another hit of dopamine. We bounce over to Facebook, we get another hit of dopamine. We go back to Instagram, we get another hit of dopamine. Bouncing around in this dopamine-fueled feedback loop. And really, it is chemical reinforcement that happens after we engage with a certain behavior. So step one is to identify all of the things that are driven by dopamine, the dopaminergic activities that you want to weed out, whether it's digital news, whether it's social media, whether it's video games, you name it, whatever you engage with for the purposes of a hit of novelty. And then the fun part is you identify some well-rounded activities, maybe preferably in the analog world, that lead you to feel connected with other people, that lead you to feel proud, that lead you to feel a rush, like going for a workout or maybe a DIY project around the house, volunteering, getting a massage, playing an instrument. I picked up the piano during my first one and haven't really put it down since. Then you choose a duration. I like to do it for a period of around a month. And you do the experiment. And the key is to notice what changes in how you're able to focus, in how ideas flow, in how calm you feel, in just how present you feel with what you're doing and the people that you're with. Because the best strategies out there for productivity, for calm, for our mental health, for all of these different factors, in my opinion, are self-reinforcing. So in other words, we notice them working, which drives a feedback loop of sorts to continue to engage with the change that we're engaging with to continue to receive those benefits. But that process of noticing what changes is critical. Identify what to weed out, introduce some things that are well-rounded, choose a duration, notice what changes. And if you're like me, you might be surprised by how well something like this works for lowering that stimulation level of your mind, which is a critical factor I found in how calm we feel.
And it wasn't just digital stimulants you removed, right? You took out food, some like junk food and coffee as well.
Yeah, there are novel things that exist in the analog world as well. Most of the novelty I found in my own life, maybe because at the time, the greatest proportion of my day was looking at a screen. And this happened especially after COVID, where our daily screen time shot up past 13 and a half hours every day, and we're awake for 16 or 17 a day. And so just time-wise, most of the novelty that you engage with will likely be digital. And also, a higher proportion of what we engage with in the digital world happens to be novel than in the analog world. That's why it cries for our attention. But you're exactly right. There is a lot of analog stuff to weed out too. Shopping is one. Drug use is another one. And definitely consult with a professional if you're weaning yourself off of a substance. And processed food is another one. Processed takeout food, if you have an Uber Eats account or a Skip the Dishes account, maybe deleting the app if that's something that you have the inclination for this experiment. As with all advice, do take what works for you and leave the rest. But generally speaking, the more of these things that you endeavor to weed out, the more benefits you'll experience from it.
I wanted to talk to Chris more about this idea in the book that in the analog world and the digital world, our experiences shift time in different ways. We continued. The novelty that we find in the analog world seems to be a lot more satisfying, nourishing, and it can often help us to pause time. Whereas the novelty that we find in the digital world doesn't give us that same level of kind of nourishment and satisfaction.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such an interesting dichotomy. And it really does come back to novelty, where novel moments, especially analog ones, are kind of mile markers in time, where we can look back and see these novel moments and think, oh, that was a great memory. Oh, that was a great vacation. Oh, I loved that meal. And most of mine are meals, probably. But essentially, these novel moments become mile markers in time that we can look back. And so if you have only a few novel analog moments to look back on, there's going to be more time in between those moments. And the digital world is interesting in this regard because it's Times Square in a way, where it's quite overwhelming because of the fact that pretty much everything in the digital world has a high level of novelty. Like when we spend time in the digital world, it's not as if we're doing bookkeeping for 8 of those 13 hours a day or 10 of those 13 hours a day. We're typically bouncing between a lot of different novel sources and not really becoming deeply entrenched in any one thing that we're doing. We don't spend enough time on one thing in order to accumulate enough mental processing and kind of warm up our mind around something that we're doing. And this bears out in the research too. Gloria Mark, who I know you've had on the podcast, who is absolutely fantastic. She's found that the median time that we focus on something when we're doing work on a computer is around 40 seconds or so. And it lowers down to 35 seconds when we have I am open at the same time and other factors such as that. And so with 40 seconds of focus on something, it's very difficult to become deeply engaged with any one thing. And also, it becomes more difficult to make progress in the digital world. This is, I think, one of the reasons that freedom exists and why I personally use freedom all the time to get past that 40-second mark and do that deep work that requires this cognitive warmth and depth where we do something for long enough that we accumulate enough mental processing about it so that we can make a meaningful experience out of it and actually plant one of those mile markers in time. And so I think the duration of a task matters quite a bit in whether or not we are able to make a memory about doing something. Bouncing around between different apps on our phone every 40 seconds, it's most definitely a stimulating thing to do, but maybe it's not the most meaningful thing to do. So in the book, I separated out where the analog world is for meaning, right? It's for these deep moments where we want to look back on them and think, wow, that was good. That will extend my life because when I look back, I'll see more moments such as that. Whereas the digital world most definitely has a place too. I think, in my opinion, the digital world exists to make our lives more efficient, where the analog world exists to make our lives more meaningful. And so when we center our activities in both worlds around those two different focuses and intentions, we use our time in a way that brings us far more satisfaction, which I think is something worth optimizing for. When we look back on the time, the attention, the energy that we spend, how much satisfaction do we actually get from that time?
Yes, interesting. I would say there's a crossover point in your dichotomy there, which is probably having a fantastic podcast conversation enabled by digital. I'm not sure whether this is an analog experience right now, whether it's a digital experience right now. It certainly feels like to me something that I will remember with time.
Yeah, there are the exceptions that prove the rule. That's for sure.
Yeah, amazing. And then a huge part of your book, which I found really useful, and I remember reading the book when I was very calm because I was on a holiday and I had great intentions after reading the book. So I was like, yes, I'm going to totally change my life. But a lot of it is step by step about how to create the mechanisms, the kind of the guardrails to enable more calm. For me, the one I found most useful was recognizing this accomplishment mindset that so many of us are hardwired to, that everything in our life has to be something you're ticking off. And one of your recommendations is to time box your productivity hours. Which a busy working mum, I found that so helpful that there are times in my day when I have full permission to do anything I want that is not related to any kind of mental to-do list. So for me, that was a really useful recommendation. But I'd love to hear from you. What do you think are the best steps for people to practically take to try and encourage more opportunities for calm in their life?
Oh, so many. Blank check. Okay, I'll try to go through a bunch. So just in case people don't pick up the book or something. Dopamine is a really fascinating neurochemical. So it's what makes us love stimulation so much and gravitate to it. Because what is stimulating is novel, and what is novel releases dopamine. But you're exactly right. You know, it can be a double-edged sword where productivity is something that a lot of us value. And accomplishment is something that a lot of us value too. But there comes a point when striving for more accomplishment turns into a generalized striving for more, where instead of having goals, have just fantasies of continually accomplishing more without an endpoint in sight. And so the ironic thing about this too is that dopamine deactivates the calm network in our mind. So not to nerd out too much, but there's two kind of primary networks that I think are curious and anti-correlated with one another. So when one is activated, the other isn't. And when that one's activated, the other isn't. And those are the networks for this dopamine, right? This pursuit of accomplishment or stimulation. And that network is reverse correlated with the network that leads us to become present, right? The one that leads us to focus on the here and now is anti-correlated with the one that leads us to focus on accomplishment and stimulation. And so it's not to say that accomplishment is not worth pursuing. I think the exact opposite is the case. We just need an endpoint in sight. And that's what productivity hours does. I found this in my own days when pretty much everything became a to-do list item. Working out was on my to-do list. Going on vacation was on my to-do list. Eating a nice meal with my wife was on my to-do list. And I was looking one day, eat dinner with Arden, right next to write 500 words and thinking, wait a second, this is not something to get done. This is something that I want to deeply enjoy. And I think that flip is critical to make, because when everything is something that we wish to get done, we don't really derive much satisfaction from the things that can deliver us satisfaction when we simply pay attention to them and savor them. So productivity hours is when you define what hours of the day you wish to be productive inside of. So productivity hours, one strategy. Mentioned burnout really quickly, but it's worth thinking about how you're doing on the six factors that lead to burnout. I wrote a thing for HBR a few months ago. Time is
a blur. We can put it in the show notes, definitely. Yeah.
We'll throw it in the show notes, where essentially we have six factors of our work that cause burnout, this feeling of being exhausted, cynical, and unproductive. Those six factors, reflect on how you're doing with them. They are workload, how much control you have, how much reward you have from your work, whether that's financial or even just being recognized for contributing and doing a good job. Community, fairness, and values. There's values again. Reflect on how you're doing in those six factors. Practice savoring. Savoring is the process that we convert a positive experience into a positive emotion. And just because we experience something nice doesn't mean we'll be satisfied after, right? But think of all the delicious meals that you rush past and all the delicious cups of coffee that you just don't really pay attention to because, oh, there's email to answer and there's other things to do. But the art of savoring is setting aside that accomplishment mindset and just being with a positive experience. It trains your mind into being able to focus on the present moment. So I guess there's a few: productivity hours, savoring, and what was the other one?
Burnout levels.
Burnout. Yeah. How you're doing on the six factors of burnout. Find more analog. A lot of different strategies out there that should work for you.
Amazing. And I cannot recommend the book enough. It was a real pleasure to read. I really enjoyed it and I found it really tangible. So thank you so much, Chris. And thank you so much for sharing your wisdom today. It's been really wonderful to talk to you. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for being a guest on the Freedom Matters podcast.
Oh, so nice to chat with you too. And thank you for the kind words about the book.
Thank you for joining us on Freedom Matters. If you like what you hear, then subscribe on your favorite platform. And until next time, we wish you happy, healthy, and productive days.